second case of the day. Winning Road versus New Venture Gear. Mr. Sutherland.
Good morning, Judge Moore. If it pleases the court, I'm representing Joella Winninger. This is your classic Title VII case, and the trial court, in our view, has wrongly applied the law, usurped the role of the jury, and has required a burden of a plaintiff which cannot be met. Specifically, the court has imposed upon the plaintiff the burden of showing, subjectively, that the motive of the employer is not dishonest, citing to Stoller versus Walmart. It also talks about the court requiring us to show that the employer was lying, citing to Russell versus Acme Evans. We believe that the plaintiff did show that the employers were lying. The most obvious example of how the court need to reconsider this process of review by by deposition and declaration, as opposed to reviewing from the advantage of having a jury provide a judgment, is that when we were doing the deposition of Mr. Wade, a critical witness, his answers were so dishonest and non-responsive that we had to break off the deposition and resume it in the magistrate's jury room. And that's because he was not being honest. And that dishonesty is not going to ever show up in black and white in a deposition. It is not going to show up in the after-the-fact declarations, affidavits, and self-serving information that the employer provides. If we start from the very beginning, we have three separate theories: desperate treatment, hostile work environment, and retaliation. We have demonstrated on the record that Joella Winninger was the only woman to be offered, or the only employee to be offered a contract, as opposed to be offered a position as a salaried employee.
Well, you did concede, though, that the other people had extensive experience where she did not.
Your Honor, that's correct. That is their pretextual reasons. But if they're hiring somebody and they're coming into a new plant and they grade her as good, and they've already reviewed her qualifications, the presumption is that she's coming in to be a supervisor, not to be a trainee, not to be anything else. She has, in our view, the same standing as an employee at will. In other words, the employer cannot arbitrarily discriminate either with an employee at will on the basis of Title VII prohibitions, or in this case where she's offered a contract, which the employer argues would terminate her employment by its own terms at the end of 90 days. They have promised her, and that's the first lie. First lie is that she and everyone else is offered a three-month contract, probationary contract. The second lie is that if she performs satisfactorily, she'll be given a full salary position with benefits. And the third lie is that they will, later on, they will investigate these allegations of sexual harassment and discrimination honestly. If corporate accountability means anything today, and we know at the very top it doesn't seem to mean very much, it may even be an oxymoron. But at the bottom level, if the example is not demonstrated that an employee coming in trying to do a job, an honest job, cannot have the benefits and the protections of Title VII, and cannot have the advantage of presenting your case to a jury where the jury can look at the facts, jury can weigh credibility, and jury can weigh the totality of the circumstances. I might offer one example that I had several years ago, a Title VII trial. And one of the voir dire questions the judge asked the panel of men and women, how many of you have experienced discrimination, or somebody close to you has experienced sexual discrimination? Every woman raised their hand. None of the men did. And that tells you what the perceptions are in our society. Men don't easily recognize this. The second unfortunate result was the judge excused all those women. So I had to start over with a new panel. That is exactly what happens with a lot of employers. Discrimination is not as obvious as the courts seem to think that it should be. In other words, subjectively, if you put men and women, peers of the employee, on a jury panel and ask them, I think we'll get a very, very different reading of some of the testimony, some of the circumstances. The court went on to differentiate each of these separate incidences as if they were disconnected and unassociated. And we believe that the controlling case law requires the court to look at the totality and to look at the overall picture. If we look at just, for example, the retaliation claim that followed the sexual, what we believe to be very poignant and disgusting sexual harassment, where a coworker calls on a phone and on a speakerphone after a pretty sexually explicit question intended, obviously, to embarrass her. A reasonable jury would find that that is intimidating and that it's gender-based. The next thing that happens is that when she is called in the following day after complaining about this, one of the union committeemen, Mr. Slavin, invites her in. She thinks it's for purposes of discussing some union business, some union issue. But instead, when she goes in there, she's got two other people besides Mr. Slavin in a very small room. I visited the room. It's about 8 feet by 10 feet. It's got a metal door, and the door is locked from the inside, much the way a bathroom door can be locked from the inside. You can't come in. So if she needed some rescuing, nobody could come in. Ostensibly, it's to talk business, but instead, they get around to asking why she wouldn't offer her opinions about her preference for oral sex. She's put off by this, and she's bothered by this, she's intimidated by this, and she's frightened by this, and who wouldn't be? Think of any other circumstances in which a person in a closed room with three big men asking personal questions, trying to intimidate. In most states, there would be a crime committed there. But instead, the company says, I know you're upset, go home, come back, and we'll talk about it some more, and you can write out exactly what happened. And the company says, because the facts are not conclusive, we are not able to discipline anybody in this situation. And that's just disingenuous. That's the kind of question that should be resolved by a jury and not a trial judge, who's clearly weighing the credibility of the witnesses here, clearly looking at whether or not this subjective self-serving response is in fact going to excuse them or is pretextual. We believe that if you look at the totality of these circumstances, if Title VII has any vitality at all, then this plaintiff would have been able to demonstrate that her employment circumstances were based upon gender discrimination, and that she was given a different kind of employment arrangement, that she was not giving the training that was set, which should have been set up for her in a new situation like any new employee, and that when you look at the pretext of the company's reason for termination, poor performance, you find that the company did not follow its own policies. There's no documentation of any failings of performance, any reprimands, any counseling of any kind whatsoever. And we show by comparison that another gentleman who did have some failings was counseled, that the HR director did in fact have notes and memorandum documenting those counselings and those deficiencies. We have no such documents in Mrs. Winninger's personnel file. If that, in fact, is a policy, then wouldn't the plaintiff be entitled to the reasonable inference that there was, in fact, nothing so serious or egregious that would require her to be terminated? Or, if the court prefers, that her new arrangement, that is to be a salaried employee, would not follow her three-month contract employment. So we believe that we've raised enough inferences here for a reasonable jury of peers to see that there was a sexual discrimination in the hiring and the training, and that when she was being subjected to a hostile environment, a sexually hostile environment by the sexually explicit comments and by being locked in a room, that the company didn't respond appropriately. And that when she brought those matters to her attention, the final matter was the company said, we can't do anything about it, and she was so distraught that she was crying. Who wouldn't? Because she's going to feel very vulnerable. Anybody would feel vulnerable if the company says they can't do anything about that. And so the company co-workers then shunned her, the shift supervisor, and the other managers that she worked with had nothing to do with her for the remaining 7 days or 8 days, and then she was terminated on August the 11th.
Ms. Ellen, just with regard to that door incident, is it your understanding the door is locked, as you described it, in a bathroom fashion from the inside, or
yes,
is it locked from the outside?
No, it locks from the inside. So when you come in, you lock it, and you can go up to the door, you can unlock it and go out. But there was a big man, one of the men was standing in front of the door. She went over, pushed him aside, unlocked it, sat down. He claims to pretend to have locked it again. The point is, if you're in a room and you can't, and somebody wants to come in, somebody could not come in and see what was going on. So the security there is prohibiting somebody from coming in and interrupting what these men might be doing. There was no way that she could get out if they wanted to stop her. That was her fear. Three big men could stop her from going through that door, whether it had a lock or not. The lock prohibited people from coming in and interrupting what they were doing, which was having some fun at her expense. That's, you know, for the court to sort of start characterizing this as a misunderstanding, as a little prank, diminishes, I think, what women experience in the workplace. And what women, since World War II, they have done a fabulous job. If we're to believe the propaganda, they did admirably well in the workplace and in the factories. So what is so difficult now about judging their performance in these circumstances? Men are competing for those jobs, and the court knows that the Title VII law and background is intended to make it a level playing field so that the men cannot discriminate on the basis of gender when women come in and compete for those jobs. And we believe that's exactly what's happened here. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Surely. Thank you, Mr. Douglas. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Kathleen Anderson. I'm with the law firm of Barnes and Thornburg in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I represent New Venture Gear, which now goes by a different name. It's Manual Transmissions of Muncie, LLC. I will refer to New Venture Gear as NVG. NVG requests that you affirm the decision of the district court, both with respect to the issue of the Rule 56F motion and with respect to the motion for summary judgment, which we agree dealt with the three issues identified by Ms. Weininger's counsel. I can go into the issue of the motion for leave to conduct additional discovery, or the motion to consider newly discovered evidence. It was not addressed in Ms. Weininger's counsel in this argument. I think I'll simply state that in terms of that decision, the motion that was presented by the plaintiff before the district court was accompanied by an affidavit, and with that affidavit were some charges, some complaints of a different employee with different supervisors with different complaints. Those complaints weren't about sexual harassment. No discovery request had addressed any that particular charge. It was after the close of the briefing on the motion for summary judgment, and it was within the sound discretion of the district court to deny that motion. It did not relate to the claims of Ms. Weininger or any of her supervisors or any decision makers relating to her employment, which moves me to the key issue in this case, and that is whether the district court erred in granting New Venture Gear's motion for summary judgment. I'll address the background of New Venture Gear first. I think it's important to note that it's undisputed that New Venture Gear presents a very fast-paced manufacturing environment. They assemble transmissions and drive components. 1,300 people work there in 1.2 million square feet. Production supervisors are responsible for moving critical parts through the manufacturing process. The parts need to go, as particularly in Ms. Weininger's case, to a heat treat process in a timely fashion so that those parts can then be processed and moved back to the assembly process. Ms. Weininger was hired under a 90-day agreement precisely because she would not have been hired but for the agreement to hire under a 90-day agreement, because she did not have the qualifications. It is undisputed she had no manufacturing supervisory experience. She had experience working in a variety of employments, including Kmart, Elder Beerman's, Payless Shoes.
She never worked on a shop floor in a factory before.
She worked in a manufacturing environment at Borg Warner from 1996 to 1997, but not in any supervisory capacity. She had a brief stint as a car seat inspector at D.W. Bartlett. Other than that, her supervisory experience was limited to working at a nightclub where the bartender consulted her about hiring waitresses. 2 to 3 waitresses worked with her at a time, and they shadowed her to learn how to waitress. In terms of the interview process, there's been mention made, just in the briefing, I think, in the argument, that she was rated as a good candidate in terms of work experience. I think it's important to look at that interview summary form. The question was, does candidate's experience on other jobs relate to the work involved in this position? And the person who filled out the particular interview summary form that was available said, on a scale of 1 to 5, she was a 3. And the comment written in is, she's been a machine operator at Borg Warner. There was no understanding at any time that she had any manufacturing supervisory experience. It's not been alleged in this lawsuit. So she was hired despite that fact. At the time of hire, it was known that at the 90-day mark, she would be evaluated to determine whether she would be continued on as a regular supervisor. She received training, and there's been some mention of whether that was enough. She may have wanted more training, but she did not receive less because of her sex or because of any claim of harassment. In fact, I think it's undisputed that she received more one-on-one training than any other supervisor up to that point. And she received in the same range of classroom training as the three other male supervisors brought on at the same time. In terms of the hostile work environment claim, I think we have a very different view of facts which are undisputed. I think it's important in this case to look at the submissions of statements of material facts before the lower court. The local rule in effect at that time in the Southern District of Indiana, Rule 56.1, required each party to present those facts which were undisputed, and then a response and replies made to those facts. In terms of the alleged harassment, the tendered undisputed facts are number 195 and number 110. It's undisputed that for the purposes of summary judgment that she claims that she received a phone call from a union representative, an hourly employee, one who did not supervise her on August 1. This is close to the end of her 90-day period. She said, and there's a comment of, have you posted the WIRA job yet? I'm surprised you haven't come to look at it. Oh, you mean the posting? Yes, the posting. Oh, I was wondering what you wanted me to look at, and then laughing. She then claims that she received a second call. She claims that there was a witness in the room at the time, a witness who later reported to NBC did not recall 2 calls, but only 1. And the claim was that the same person called, and she thought so by the voice, and made a sexual comment. She told somebody at the time, I think it was just that day, August 1st, that she did not appreciate the content of the call, but did not identify what it was. The next day, she comes in, and I think it's undisputed in for the purpose of summary judgment, fact number 110, that there was this discussion about a legitimate, a casual conversation about a dispute between 2 of her employees in the office of the union representative. It's undisputed that this office was on a well-traveled area of the facility. There was a window on the door, so not only could the people inside see out, outside see in, but the people inside could see out. There was a casual conversation about 2 employees, and then there was an allegation that she was asked why she didn't respond to a subordinate about her preference in regards to oral sex. Her response to that, as she writes in a statement that is before the court, I told them that I had a department to run, and I got up and walked out. That's at tab 11, plaintiff's designation of material facts and evidence in the court below. When this was mentioned to a co-supervisor, that supervisor told management, and what happened, what should happen when an employee makes such a claim. She was brought in early. She was allowed to write out a statement. An investigation did occur. They looked at the door to figure out whether there was a lock that would preclude someone from going out. They interviewed the employee who was supposedly present. They interviewed the three union representatives. They found out that one of the union representatives was just joking in regards to the door. They attempted to trace the phone calls. They put a device on the telephone to track any further calls, and they determined that based upon what they discovered, they could not take any further action. This court has dismissed cases for much more egregious conduct than this, and we agree with the district court that this conduct is insufficient to meet the standard of a hostile work environment. In terms of the termination of Ms. Weininger's employment, or the decision that she would not continue on after the expiration of her 90-day agreement, that decision was scheduled in advance. That was going to happen before the expiration of the 90 days. Throughout her 90-day period, there were concerns about her employment. That's why she received additional training, one-on-one training. There were discussions among Earl Davis, a retired supervisor who was brought in to give her additional training, Mr. Pence, who was in human resources, Mr. Johnson, who trained her one-on-one, and Mr. Russ Wade, who spoke with Brian Allum, who made the decision that she would not continue on. Now, the straw that broke the camel's back was when Mr. Butch Wade told Ms. Weininger that it was a critical day. She needed to get the parts to heat treat in batches of 16. She admits that she was responsible for getting those parts to heat treat. In her deposition at page 157 to 58, the question was, you were in charge of getting parts to heat treat, correct? Right. And they didn't get the heat treat, right. This is on July 27th, close to the close of her 90-day period, and at a time when they already had concerns about her performance. 5 hours into that shift, Butch Wade, who directed her, discovered that no parts, absolutely no parts, had gone to heat treat as he had instructed her. This is a man who's in charge of the 1.2 million square feet. 12 to 14 other supervisors, and she complains at that point that he cussed her out for it. Well, of course he cussed her out for it because it was a serious problem in the manufacturing process, and in fact the next day the manufacturing line shut down because of that error. It's important to note the testimony of Mr. Salmon, who said that he dealt with similar problems as Ms. Weininger. He had problems finding truckers or forklifts. He had trouble with getting parts to heat treat at time and times. What did he do? He at times put the parts onto a cart and physically moved them himself. He at times got someone else on a less critical job to come in and get the parts to heat treat. Ms. Weininger, who was in charge of getting the parts to heat treat, did not do that, and as a result, the operation shut down. That was a critical issue that caused sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. It was for performance reasons that NVG decided that it would not continue her agreement beyond the 90 days. There's been no pretext shown in relation to that decision. And I've noted as well that there are items that have been alleged in terms of she heard rumors in the workplace about people talking about how, for instance, that another supervisor said she wouldn't make it because she was female. not supported by any admissible evidence. She didn't hear the statement, and it was reported to her by others. And nothing ties Mr. Allen's decision to her sex or to any claim that she was subjected to a hostile work environment. Unless the court has any questions, I will rely on the briefing and on the record below and request that the court grant or affirm the lower court's decision on summary judgment in relation to the Rule 56 motion.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Sutherland.
Thank you, Judge Baum. Very briefly, let me touch on the Hirschenroeder additional information. That came to our attention during the briefing process. We had requested all the individuals' names of anyone who had suffered sexual discrimination, or rather sexual harassment, and that name was not produced. Our contention is that in spite of the court's analysis of this as a different situation, the eventual decision makers are HR, the same HR people, Mr. Pence and Mr. Luce. So in that situation, when you talk about a policy that's company-wide, the harassment or the discrimination may be at the lowest factory line level, but the ratification and the approval of that has to occur at the HR level where they look the other way or ignore it. And that's what happened, we think, in Mrs. Hirschenroeder's case. And we believe that the court, which did not address timeliness, should have allowed that in because if it's relevant or it's probative, it should have been allowed. And it would not have delayed anything that to any appreciable extent. What I heard counsel for the defendant say, which is exactly why things should go to the jury trial, we have a different view of the undisputed facts. We have a different look at the undisputed facts. If this was such an egregious event where Ms. Weininger caused the shutdown of the plant, why wasn't she fired then? Why wasn't there a memorandum? And if the court takes the time to find in our reference to the record, Mr. Wade said, it is part of my job. I'm part of the redundancy. If you can't find a trucker, call me. She claims to have called him 5 times. And he said, if you don't get to me, it's my fault. That is a fact question for the jury. We're not talking about whether they did a right job or wrong job at this and making a decision to fire her. What we're talking about, if there are disputed facts and she's complaining about being set up and she's complaining about being treated differently, and we offer a lot of evidence of that, a lot of evidence of that. Nobody had ever heard of anybody being put on a contract before. Nobody had heard of any complaints about her performance. She volunteered a lot of time, extra time that she wasn't compensated for, to work over, to make her records complete, to do the counts and that kind of thing. She was doing everything she could to make it appear that she wanted to keep that job. And instead, the union people were yanking her around by playing these sexual games. It's the kind of sexual games that you should be able to go to HR and get some redress for. And if you don't, that failure seems to me, in the eyes of most jurors, is going to ratify a company policy that diminishes women's place in the workplace.
Does the evidence disclose whether there are any other women supervisors in that sort of on-the-floor type job in that company?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Does the evidence disclose, or the information submitted, disclose there were other female supervisors of that level in that company?
There aren't. Mrs. Hirschenroeder is in another department, but she has similar role, similar position, supervising, I think, as many as 150 men at one time. We submitted an affidavit of Ms. Chambers, though, which demonstrated that she had a supervisory position, I don't know whether it was exactly comparable, in which she attempted to discipline somebody. And then when she did, she got harassing phone calls at home. That affidavit was submitted to demonstrate that there isn't a real protection in this plan when you bring to the HR's attention is situations of discrimination. Mr. Couch had a reputation of being that way. He was transferred, but he was not disciplined. Transfer is not discipline. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sutherland. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.